This report is part of WNPR's Mental Health Reporting Series, made possible by our founding partner, Hartford Healthcare Behavioral Health Network.
This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. The death of comedian Robin Williams caught almost everyone by surprise. His enormous presence on stage contained an energy level that was unmatched.
Soccer's kind of mellow. You know, it's a little passive-aggressive, though, when you got that thing of like, I didn't do anything. What are you looking at? It's not like hockey where someone comes up with a stick and goes, bam!
Author and mental health advocate Andrew Solomon wrote about Williams' death for The New Yorker, and here's what he said. We lionized Robin Williams for the manic gleam in his performances. At his best, he was not only hilarious, but also enchantingly frenzied. There are very few people who have that kind of wild energy who don't dip the other way sometimes. It often seems as if those who are most exuberant experience despair in proportion to their joy. They seem to swing wildly about the neutral average. Solomon has suffered from depression himself. Earlier this year, I moderated a discussion with him at the Connecticut Forum where he talked about depression.
I would start by saying that it's a significant poverty of the language that we use the same word to describe how a child feels when it rains on the day of his baseball game and how someone feels who decides to commit suicide. That we use this one word, which has both a colloquial and a clinical application, and it would be helpful if we had separate vocabulary. Having said that, I think depression lies on a continuum with ordinary sadness and pain and withdrawal, that many of the things that are characteristic of the clinical condition of major depression are initially similar to things that are typical of someone who's just having a bad day or a rough time. I always say that the opposite of depression is not happiness, but vitality. And when someone is severely depressed, what they lose is the vitality. It's the will to live. It's the energy to do things. It's the ability to engage themselves with the business of life. It's not just that they feel really, really sad the way that someone does who's experienced a loss and is going through grief. I also think there's a complicated relationship between illness and personality, and that there are some people who have experiences of very extreme depression who in some way are able to keep up a better facade than other people are. But the fact that someone is functioning during a depression doesn't mean the depression isn't really acute. When you ask about the distinction between depression and ordinary sadness or ordinary grief, I sometimes think that it's, you know, you talk about a fence that's rusting, and you would use the same word rust if the fence had a couple of little orange spots on it. And you would also use that word if it had crumbled into nothing but powder. And it's the same phenomenon, and it's happened to the same fence, but they're two very different situations. And one of them you can probably fix with a lick of paint, and in the other, there's nothing there to fix. And I often feel when I talk to people who are experiencing major depression that they are, in fact, moving toward being that completely collapsed fence, which is not to say that major depression is not in many instances treatable and that many people don't manage to resolve it. But it's something that sort of, it's a gradual blurring where it goes from being a normal set of moods and circumstances to being something completely intolerable, unlivable, unmanageable, devastating, and paralyzing.
That was author Andrew Solomon speaking earlier this year at the Connecticut Forum. Today, Where We Live, we will revisit a conversation about suicide. At the time, we were joined by Dr. Lisa Namoro, a child and adolescent psychiatrist and director of consultation services to Connecticut Children's Medical Center at the Institute of Living at Hartford Hospital. Dr. Harold Schwartz is a psychiatrist and chief and vice president of behavioral health at Hartford Hospital and the Institute of Living, director of the Department of Psychiatry. Dr. Schwartz described suicide as a major killer.
It stands beside cancer and heart disease, and we think, you know, people really are not aware. As you mentioned, there will be 40,000 suicide deaths in America. There will be almost a million worldwide this year. And for every actual suicide, there are at least 10 attempts. So we're thinking that there are that there will be at least a million attempts in the United States. For every attempt, there probably are 10 times more people with suicidal ideation. So we're talking 10 million at least people with suicidal ideation. And we just have to break the barriers of stigma that stand in the way of discussion about suicide and realization that suicide needs the same degree of attention, the same degree of public health resources and medical resources as all of the other major killers.
I just when you say that it stands next to cancer and heart disease as killers, that is something that, that makes me stand up and say, whoa, we're spending an awful lot of time and money, research, in trying to solve the problem of cancer, to try to solve the problem of heart disease, and giving people any number of different types of drugs to solve those problems. But yet you're saying that suicide, something we talk very much less about, is killing people at around the same rate.
That's right. And we do spend some money on mental health or mental disorder research, but certainly suicide is sort of the dark secret, not discussed, shamefully held in people's minds, and it's certainly not getting the kind of attention that it ought to get.
I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit more, Doctor, about the stigma and what exactly we mean when we talk about the stigma surrounding suicide. What is it, and what is it that we're trying to solve, trying to get around?
It's often quite a secret when somebody makes any sort of an attempt. And it's certainly often a secret if there's a completed suicide. People don't always know the words to describe what's happened to a loved one. They don't know how to tell others. They don't know how to tell family members. Within the medical profession, often it's a secret, particularly if you're among a treatment team that's part of care for a patient who completes suicide. I think it's primarily often a language issue. What words do you use? What words do you use that can convey non-judgment? And so I think due to that sort of that it's a behavior-based event, it often has a sense that somebody could have just not done that, just stopped.
No, Dr. Schwartz, you were on our air on a piece that Jeff Cohen, our reporter, did about a man named Homer Bell who dealt with very serious mental health issues for quite some time. In his 50s, after years of trying to seek help, he killed himself. And one of the things you said that kind of stuck with us was this idea that in Homer Bell's case, this idea, this suicidal ideation, is almost a death sentence. It's something that eventually is going to get to someone like him, but clearly not everyone who attempts suicide is exactly having the same experience. Can you talk about these differences between people whose suicidal ideation for many years is so strong and so powerful that it may put them in one class, and then others who may attempt for the very first time and not be in the same class from a medical perspective?
Sure. I think first I want to get the message out that suicidal ideation does not have to be a death sentence. At the same time, there are a certain number of people, a certain percentage of people, who will kill themselves despite the best efforts of family, of loved ones, of mental health clinicians. And this is why I like to say, especially to my own staff, that for a certain segment of individuals, suicidal ideation is a terminal illness. Mm-hmm. Now, we can't really discriminate what it is that makes suicidal ideation so terminal for some, excuse me,
sure,
but not for others. But we can say that the critical issue is the willingness to talk about it, the willingness to reveal what you're thinking, to share your experience with others. We can have patients in therapy. We can have patients in hospital. We can be addressing suicide as vigorously as we can. If the individual in his own heart and mind has made a decision that he or she is going to kill him or herself and that they're not going to share that information with us, ultimately those individuals have terminal suicidal ideation.
So how do you recognize someone who might be at risk?
Yeah, so one of the things that we see a lot of at the Connecticut Children's Medical Center are children who have made an attempt but have survived. So they're either in our emergency room or they are up on our medical floors. And so we have an opportunity to really explore what were the things that were going on that led to this moment, this very vulnerable moment where an adolescent felt like the only way out was to reach for something or do something that resulted in self-harm. And among those adolescents, the stuff we're looking for is marked anger, rage, dysphoria, failure in the domains that adolescents live in, particularly school and friends. And so those are the – so we spend probably about 2.5 to 3 hours with these adolescents and their families trying to determine how at risk they now are for a subsequent attempt. And given that, what kind of treatment that they need. We know that – and this is across both adolescents and adults – that once you have had a suicide attempt, you are 30 to 40 times more likely to do it again, regardless of reason why. Which provides for us an opportunity of a particularly high-risk group that we can target, we can investigate causes, and we can get into treatment. So there are certain things that we are looking for, again, that might lead us to be able to say, this person is at particularly high risk, and we have to give it all we got to make sure that that adolescent or adult doesn't do that again.
Well, and we'll be focusing on adolescents a bit later on in the program, but I would like to ask you, when we have someone who is, let's say, a teenager and who exhibits some of the types of behavior that you're just talking about, I think a lot of parents, a lot of friends, a lot of family would say, well, that's a teenager being a teenager. That's someone acting like I'm used to teenagers acting, slamming the door behind and all of a sudden in a fit of anger. How do you distinguish the potentially suicidal teenager from just a kid going through the typical mood swings of childhood?
Yeah, that is one of the complexities of adolescence because, unfortunately, it is such a turbulent time. Unfortunately, adolescents don't always think using their cortex. They act using pieces of their brain that have nothing to do with thinking. They will often say, I wasn't thinking. What were you thinking? I wasn't thinking. And so it does make it somewhat challenging. But the truth of the matter is there is a degree of that that is regular and part of adolescence. And then there is a degree in which it begins to impair function, in which it results in withdrawal from daily activities, in which it results in impairment of academic function, withdrawal from friends, boredom, anger, restlessness, marked impulsivity. There is a degree to which it is now no longer part of what would be considered normal adolescent behavior.
The number 211 is one that we'll be giving out in case you need to seek help yourself. We'd like to go to John, who's in West Hartford. Hello, John. Go ahead. John, where we live.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. I've known a couple of people, had somebody in my family who had suicidal thoughts, a friend of mine who actually attempted suicide. One of the things that I really found frustrating in the aftermath of those situations was the issue of health insurance and life insurance, that it makes it really, really difficult to purchase both of those things for somebody who's attempted suicide and has that on their medical records. It's almost like the consequences of somebody attempting suicide punishes them and makes it not only harder for them, but their family. And it just seems to, in my mind, that it would just perpetuate. Well, the person thinks, well, now I'm a burden to my family, might as well try it again and finish the job. It just really seems to be you're punishing the person for something that they can't control.
John, thank you for raising this. And both the Dr. Schwartz and Amaro are nodding their heads here. Dr. Schwartz?
I just want to say this is the opportunity to make a pitch for healthcare reform, because the problem that you're describing is the problem of pre-existing conditions when you're going to when you're attempting to get healthcare insurance. And one of the things that the Affordable Care Act does do, and I think will do successfully, is that it eliminates the capacity of insurance companies to deny insurance on the basis of a pre-existing condition.
I want to welcome into the conversation Andrea Duarte, who's a behavioral health program manager at Connecticut Department of Mental Health and Addiction Services, co-chair of the Connecticut Suicide Advisory Board. Thank you so much for being here as part of the conversation as well.
Thank you for having me, John.
I'm wondering if you can talk about some statewide programs to kind of raise awareness. We talk about stigma off the top of the program, how important it is, and the doctors have made a very passionate case for this. Well, what's the state doing to help people?
Sure. We have a statewide campaign called the One Word, One Voice, One Life, Be the One to Start the Conversation. And as the doctors previously stated in this conversation of ours, that it's important to get that, to get, you know, it out that it's okay to talk about suicide. It's not going to put the idea in someone's head. It's important to get them to help. And to know what to look for, what the warning signs and risk factors are, as they were just speaking about. The other thing that we bring into it, in addition to the warning signs that were already discussed, is the issues of substances and substance use as part of the risk factors, and especially with adolescents that can also come into play. Going back to the campaign, we are promoting this campaign at various levels through the state, schools, campuses, towns, regional organizations, just trying to get it out in every way, shape, and form. We have multiple materials. We have a website, preventsuicidect.org, and materials are available free by ordering on the website.
One of the things that I'm sure some of our callers are thinking about, and something that we've talked with Dr. Schwartz about in the aftermath of what happened at Newtown, is we got into a conversation across the state and across the country, really, about mental health services and about whether or not there were enough mental health services to take care of people. I'm wondering if you can address that issue in the context of suicide today, the idea that we've heard over and over again that whether or not it's for young people or for people in middle age, there aren't enough placements, enough places for people to get the help that they need. Where do we stand?
Mm-hmm. I'll do the best I can with that. I know that in our state, we are very fortunate to have quite a number of licensed clinicians that can provide mental health services. Some of the challenges that many clinicians have voiced is limited training related to suicide ideation specifically. Often it's not something that they learn in their master's level programs. Depending on the program, they will have various level of training on that. And so offering training in those areas are really important. We at Department of Mental Health and Addiction Services do have some training for DEMIS staff and agencies funded by DEMIS. We also have training available through the state initiative on Prevent Suicide CT, open to clinicians. With that said, the resources can be there, and if the individuals are not talking about it at the ground level and getting to those services, self-identification and other individuals identifying others and leading them to help, then the connections aren't made.
Is it safe to say that we have a problem with services in the state?
Well, you know, I would agree with Andrea. I think that, yes, at baseline, that we could have more mental health services everywhere in America. Connecticut actually, in terms of public services, stands as one of the better mental health services in the country. And the issue of insurance for those who are privately insured and seeking care that way, of course, always is an issue. But when it comes to suicide, to my mind, the issue is the individual's willingness to access services far and away. You know, we were talking about stigma earlier, and I would frame the stigma issue by suggesting that suicide is considered a shameful act by many, if not most, the families who have to live with it and the individuals who might who are considering committing it. And it's considered a shameful act because it's seen as a moral failure. As Dr. Namara was suggesting, it's always an individual choice. It's not like a cancer that must and will take your life. And in that regard, that sense of moral failure and shame keeps so many people from accessing services.
Well, it's a core to many faith traditions that it is indeed a moral failure, and this is a big part of our society.
That is absolutely correct.
That's Dr. Hank Schwartz. He's psychiatrist-in-chief and vice president of behavioral health at Hartford Hospital and the Institute of Living. He's director of the Department of Psychiatry there. We're also joined by Dr. Lisa Namara, who's child and adolescent psychiatrist and director of consultation services to Connecticut Children's Medical Center and the Institute of Living in Hartford Hospital. Also, Andrea Duarte, behavioral health program manager at Connecticut Department of Mental Health and Addiction Services and co-chair of the Connecticut Suicide Advisory Board. We're revisiting a conversation today about suicide on Where We Live. You can join the conversation on our website, WNPR.org, or on Facebook and Twitter, at Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Suicide is the third leading cause of death for those aged 10 to 24 and second among college students. For every completed suicide, there are many more who think about it, plan it, or end up in the emergency room. Suicide is preventable, though, if we know the risk factors and how to cultivate behaviors that protect our kids. I want to welcome to the conversation Marissa Porco, who is president of the Jordan Matthew Porco Memorial Foundation. Thank you so much for coming in. I really appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
So I'm wondering first if you can tell me the story of your son.
My son was a freshman at St. Michael's College up in Vermont. He had been there about 6 months. His first choice college. He had been there. He was there with several friends from high school and grammar school. And second semester, we knew that he was struggling with, you know, maybe what major he wanted to be, whether or not he wanted to take a gap year. We hadn't seen him for a month. We had dropped him off January 16th, and he died by suicide on February 16th.
Mm. I'm very sorry, first of all, and I thank you for sharing your story here. What did you, as we talk about signs and how people might be able to get others talking about it, what did you see? What did you know? Did you have any inkling that this would happen?
No, we had no idea. And if you knew my son, who was very, you know, he had a lot of friends. He was very active. He loved to snowboard, longboard. He was very active young adult. I think you would say he'd be the last person that you would think that would die by suicide. And we were not with him. We were planning to see him that weekend. We're in constant contact with him. The only information that we have are from his friends that were with him that had noticed some behavioral changes in the last 2 to 3 weeks.
So, Lisa Namoro, your child and adolescent psychiatrist, how typical is the story that we're hearing right now?
I can't cite the exact number, but it's not uncommon, right, that we do speak a lot about the warning signs, and we do speak a lot about what we can, you know, kids who are at risk, but there is a certain segment that catches us by complete and total surprise. You know, lots of skills, lots of social functioning, good academics, a beloved kid, and, you know, those are often the ones that just take our breath away.
And so from your perspective, I mean, what do you learn from this? How do you handle this? Because, it seems to fly in the face, and it's also why it shocks us, but it flies in the face of everything we seem to know about suicide.
So there is some, you know, there's a lot of work. There's something called a psychological autopsy that gets done on completed suicides in which you do go back and just try to parcel out exactly what was going on and were there any signs. And it does turn out sometimes to be that there were some, particularly friends, noticed some stuff. But again, given that there are others who might have shown those exact signs or symptoms, do you put everybody in the category of high risk? But I think if there's this sense that the more we can educate people to looking for those signs. I mean, I always feel like so we overcall it, right? Yeah. So we get the mobile crisis team out to look at somebody who had no, you know, no risk whatsoever. We lose nothing. And I think that's the sense, that we should overcall rather than undercall.
We lose nothing. But, Marissa, I'm sure that you're sensitive to this something that has changed, I think, in American society over the years. It's something we've talked about on the program before. It's that many children – especially those who get a chance to go to college, who have healthy, good lives, are in many ways by their parents and by society coddled. We worry about them constantly. We constantly think that something's wrong. Oh, my goodness, he's gotten a B when he always gets A's. And do you think that there's that risk, too, that indeed you could look and look and look, but you may never find anything wrong with a child like your son?
Yes, I think so. I know that the few things that we did hear after he passed away was that he had stopped eating. He was eating a lot less, and there were some behavior changes in terms of it. Just he wasn't himself. He just wasn't himself. And so what we don't know is whether or not he had stopped sleeping. You know, if he had any sleep disturbances. We feel that maybe he had some level of agitation, but other than that, we don't know. But I do understand when it comes to these students or kids that are going off to college and they kind of have everything laid out and things are going according to plan. It's very difficult.
I want to get to the phones here. David is on the line. Hi, David. Go ahead. You're on Where We Live.
Hello. I'm very sorry to hear about this young man. My son just went off to college. And one thing that I did that I think is a good thing, I hope it's a good thing, which I think a lot of parents could do, is even if you don't consider that your own son or daughter could do this, is to have a talk with them before they go. I mean, I found that the best times for talking with my son are in the car. So before he went, we talked about sex. We talked about drugs. We talked about alcohol. But knowing a few kids who had committed suicide in college, we also talked about suicide. And I went through and we reminding him of this college's health center being available, learning assistance available, resident assistance available, and telling him, you can always talk with me. We're talking about suicide here, something that we haven't talked about, but there's no shame in it. Nothing can be so bad, because the kids that I knew who committed suicide over being dumped by a girlfriend or a bad grade, you know, they could have had a wonderful family, such as we have. They could have had joy in having children. They could have had bright careers that contributed so much to society. Mm-hmm. And so I told him, you know, please, if you ever have this, speak up. It's okay.
Well, and I think, first of all, David, thank you very much for your phone call. And I think this idea of just reminding your child that there are services available on campus, it's just knowing that there's a place to get help. But, Marissa, maybe you could quickly respond to David's
yes,
call.
Yes, thank you for calling in. I am a career social worker, and this subject had never been a taboo in my family. I had several conversations with my son, and if you want to talk about protective factors, I feel that my son did have a lot of the protective factors that reduce the risk of suicide. I think despite this, one of the things that led us to do the work that we're doing right now is I think that sometimes when you're in that dark place, even though you know better, and that's what I always say, that my son Jordan knew better, that I don't think you can get yourself out of that dark place, and that's where having educating peers and staff and faculty about some of the warning signs is so important, because reaching out to somebody who might be in distress and understanding that it could be a risk, especially with this under 25 age group, is really important. I think parents need to have these conversations. I think schools need to have these conversations before the kids go off to college, and I think it's important for our young adults to have these conversations with each other.
Yeah, we actually got one call from Susan who couldn't stay on the line but said she wanted to say she thinks there needs to be integration in the school system, in the K through 12 school system, peer groups that might meet weekly as part of a curriculum, something to actually talk about in schools. I know Andrea Duarte, who's here from the Department of Mental Health and Addiction Services, you wanted to jump in.
Sure. The first thing I wanted to just say is it's never one thing that people consider suicide. It's a confluence of factors. So it's never just the breakup. It's never just a loss. It's never just the financial situation or the bullying. It's a combination of various kinds of stressors that lead someone to considering suicide. And not only that, but it's important to remember that if someone's in poor mental health, experiencing stress, experiencing depression or anxiety, it's important to seek mental health assistance before you even get to the point of considering suicide. And it's been interesting in our work at the state level and with a federal grant we have, we've been able to connect with a number of other state, federal, and tribe and campuses nationwide. And there's a study in Ohio that was done on campuses. And what they found was that students, although they needed mental health services, didn't seek it. And it wasn't the stigma that was in the way. It was that they just didn't think it was a bad enough issue to seek mental health. And they just, you know, either couldn't be bothered or it just didn't seem that bad until it's kind of like a scale. And this one straw was added to one side and then it's a tipping point for them. So it's really important in a lot of what our education is, both Marissa and myself, and our work in the state with many, many partners, is to make the connections for people, to try and help people put the puzzle pieces together in a community, whatever the environment is, so that they can help get people who are in poor mental health to assistance before they start even considering suicide.
Well, please go ahead.
If I could just go on.
Yeah.
The single event, I think that is so important. Mm-hmm. John, you came in this morning and said you had a cold, and mm-hmm. you're battling that a little bit. I think that's sort of the way to look at the vulnerability that we're talking about here, that if you're walking around with some level of anxiety, as some of us were this morning, or, you know, mood disturbance, you are in a more vulnerable place. You are less strong. It's like your ankle has been twisted. And then, given that state, if then something happens, like the breakup or like the bad grade or like being overwhelmed with all the assignments you have at college, you are less strong to manage that. And then you can lead to the moment where you have no strength left. You're weak. And then other parts of your brain take over, which is really what we think the actual suicide attempt is driven by. It's not, again, driven by the top of your brain or the thinking part of your brain. It's driven by this other, darker, emotional place.
But this impulsive type of behavior that David, our caller, was talking about, someone who may act after a bad breakup, something that adults would see as something we could deal with, students sometimes aren't able to deal, it seems, with that life situation. Not even acting out in terms of suicide, but just in the way they react to the bad breakup or something happening with a grade. Is there something different about the brains of the adolescent, doctor, and the brains of the adult in the way that they might approach that impulsivity? Something bad happens and now I'm going to snap.
So impulsivity is a very important word in this world, actually. You know, impulsivity is a brain-based thing. In fact, infants are born with being somewhere on the scale of impulsivity, sort of low or high. You can tell an impulsive toddler by 16 to 18 months of age, you know, the one who's much more likely to put their finger in the electric socket. So impulsivity is a very hardwired thing. Now, again, that doesn't mean all impulsive kids, toddlers, kids, adults are going to reach or do something. But that is a high risk factor. And that is one of the things we actually look for in our evaluation is level of impulsivity, because those are the kids who are more prone to act before thinking. Now, the problem with adolescents, and all our functional MRI scans show this to be true, is that adolescents somewhere between 14 and 21 do stop using the thinking part of their brain to solve problems. If you put adolescents in a functional MRI and you have them just problem solve, they are less likely to use the top of their brain than an 11-year-old. So there is this unfortunate time period between 14 and 21 in which the cortex is not being used as well as it should be anymore.
And this is not a metaphor you're using.
This is true.
This is brain science.
This is brain science. Yeah. And so, again, we feel like we now have the neurobiology to the adolescent who says, when you say, what were you thinking? And they say, I wasn't thinking. We now know why. Now,
that's I just have to say, for many parents listening to the show, I think that that is an important distinction, because I think many parents who we've talked to in the past see it as a metaphor. You know, kids don't think sometimes. What you're saying is sometimes kids don't think. It shows up on the MRI.
Yes. And if you do an experiment where the task that they have to problem solve about is emotional, now you're really in trouble, because now they're even less likely to use the top of their brain. So, again, when you take the pool of sadness, anxiety, whatever that's making somebody feel weaker, and then on top of it, you inject some tough moment. It is in that moment where often these things happen.
Dr. Schwartz?
I would just add to that that in addition to adolescents not using this part of the brain, we know that the frontal cortex is not fully matured until at least 25. You know, if we were to redefine childhood and adolescence and young adulthood, adolescence would clearly go into the mid-20s. And I think just about every day we push that line back even further. So frontal cortex development, the actual brain power, you know, isn't there. The brain power people aren't tapping into isn't even there.
Well, okay, so before we take our break here, as we talk about impulsivity in young people and adolescents maybe going closer to 30, and so we're talking about a big chunk of the population, let's talk about risk factors. We've talked about this in the program before. Dr. Schwartz, look, the young man who killed himself in Greenwich killed himself with a gun. Access to weapons at home, not just for young people, but for people of all ages, seems to correlate very, very positively with suicide. We've had on Dr. Miller from Harvard talking about these numbers, the thousands and thousands of people who die in places where there are more guns versus places where there are fewer guns. I assume that this is one of the risk factors you've taken a look at. Maybe you can talk just about a bit more about guns and suicide for us.
The access to a gun is a huge suicide risk factor. We have studies that suggest that for those who kill themselves impulsively, that the presence of the means is the critical issue. If the gun were not present, the suicidal impulse that actually leads to an act might pass within 5, 10, or 15 minutes. It's the presence of the gun that hugely increases the risk, so that gunshot is the number one cause of suicide in America. And there are more deaths by suicide with guns than there are by homicide in America. So access is a huge issue, as it is for the second leading cause of suicide, which is overdose, drugs, and alcohol, which are so present in our lives. The third leading cause is hanging, and just about anybody can put together a bed sheet or obtain a piece of rope.
But those last two, again, one by hanging, it involves something that is very different than the impulse to pick up a gun, which is meant to essentially hurt and kill. That's what its main job is. People know what a gun is for, versus overdosing on pills, which are meant for something else, but you have to decide to use them to try to hurt yourself.
Yes, so what you're suggesting is that the difference between the planned suicide and the impulsive suicide, which is a conundrum for many of us who try to treat individuals who are suicidal. And there just is not a distinct line between the two, because people may be thinking about suicide. They may even be talking about it with their clinicians or with friends and with families, seeking help. But then that sudden event that we were speaking about earlier may occur, and the impulse to die at that moment may be overwhelming. And the entire difference between ideation and the actual act of suicide may simply be the presence of the gun.
I cannot underscore that enough. We spend a lot of time, when I speak of the cohort that we have the opportunity to work with at the Connecticut Children's Medical Center, that is the time that we spend. In fact, any kid seen for behavioral health reasons anywhere in our system, part of what we speak to, again, just like the toddler, you know, we spend hundreds of dollars child-proofing our homes with the plastic things that go in plugs and the stuff that disallows opening up cabinets. That's what we need to do with our homes, particularly if we have an adolescent that is more reactive, that is more impulsive, and then particularly if we have an adolescent who is being treated for mental health disturbances, and then for sure mandatory if we have an adolescent who has had a suicide attempt and has survived. That particular group, we speak to parents at length about locking things up. And unfortunately, it's very awkward. It's very awkward to have a home, except, again, I remind them that they did that when their child was 2 and 3 and 4. And so it is that moment, if you can block access during that dark, vulnerable moment, you can potentially make a difference.
That's Dr. Lisa Namoro, child and adolescent psychiatrist and director of consultation services to Connecticut Children's Medical Center at the Institute of Living at Hartford Hospital. We're listening back to a conversation we had on this program about suicide. The death of Robin Williams has brought this topic back to the mainstream. We're revisiting the program that originally aired in September of last year. We're also joined in this conversation by Dr. Harold Schwartz from the Institute of Living and Andrea Duarte, who's behavioral health program manager at Connecticut Department of Mental Health and Addiction Services. Also, Marisa Porco, who's the president of the Jordan Matthew Porco Memorial Foundation. When we come back from our break, we'll hear more from these experts. You can join the conversation about suicide on our website, WNPR.org, or find us on Facebook and Twitter, at Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up tomorrow, it's our weekly news roundtable, The Wheelhouse. Colin McEnroe will be sitting in my usual seat, taking your phone calls about the week's news, but I'll be in Washington, D.C., hosting from there, from the headquarters of NPR. I hope you can join us. Today, in the wake of Robin Williams' death a few weeks back, we're revisiting a conversation that we've had about suicide here on the show. Our guests are Dr. Harold Schwartz. He's psychiatrist-in-chief and vice president of behavioral health at Hartford Hospital and the Institute of Living. Dr. Lisa Namoro, who's child and adolescent psychiatrist and director of consultation services to Connecticut Children's Medical Center at the Institute of Living at Hartford Hospital. And Andrea Duarte, who's behavioral health program manager at Connecticut Department of Mental Health and Addiction Services. She also serves as co-chair of the Connecticut Suicide Advisory Board. And Marissa Porco is with us, president of the Jordan Matthew Porco Memorial Foundation. Let's listen to a call that we got from Nancy on the phone.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I think first off, I'd like to say that society has a big ball in this as far as having expectations for kids to getting into so much responsibility at such an early age. But yet they don't teach people, young kids, how to cope and how to problem solve. And those are two key issues that probably would be extraordinarily helpful to kids in their development years. But I have a situation where my husband has tried to commit suicide many times. And I think the best place to go is UConn, the fifth floor. They have an inpatient program there that teaches people who have bipolar or mental disorders how to cope, and learning coping skills, meditation, learning how to cope. Society is just so overwhelming just for the average person who doesn't have mental health issues. But then you look at people who do have the mental health issues, you know, they're dually challenged.
Then
you talk about drugs and alcohol with kids. That doesn't help the situation.
And Nancy, I'm going to let you go just because I want to actually get to drugs and alcohol quickly because we have a lot of people who want to get involved in the conversation. So thank you. Very quickly, doctors, what do people do? I mean, if they have somebody who has attempted suicide or they're scared of them, what's the first thing they should do? Just so we make sure we say this out loud to people here.
If somebody is actively suicidal, the first thing somebody should do is get them to help. That often means bringing them to an emergency room. You've got to keep somebody safe. Safety is the number one issue. That might mean that hospitalization is required. Not necessarily, but certainly rapid access to some additional level of treatment.
The child and adolescent world, the mobile crisis team, I'm less familiar in the adult world, but it is a fabulous regionalized program here in the state of Connecticut, and anyone can access that. So a parent can call and say, I'm very worried about my child. She hasn't gotten out of bed for 3 days. Can you come? They will come. They will do an eval. It can happen at schools. It can happen in providers' offices. Very important.
And this is the number we gave out before. This is 211.
Yes. They can also do evaluations at home. In fact, I think the primary requesters are parents. Yes, 211 United Way manages that service.
Marissa, I'm wondering if you can talk a bit more about what you're doing as part of the Jordan Matthew Porco Memorial Foundation.
One of the things we did after my son died is that we just really felt that we needed to get more information out there to people. So we started the Jordan Matthew Porco Memorial Foundation. We spent a lot of time talking to national organizations that are concentrated on working with college-age students. And one of the programs we started was Fresh Check Day, which is an interactive expo-like event at colleges. We kick off the event with a nationally known speaker, and we bring in therapy dogs and vibrational sound massage as a kickoff and a teaser to get the kids interested. And then the day of the event, we have interactive tents, and we work with the colleges to put together it's not a tabling event. It's really an interactive event. So you may have the housing or the RA, the residential directors, working on a tent. You may have a counseling center working on a tent, different organizations on campus. And it's really peer-to-peer messaging, interactive fun. We have music. We have food, two things that really attract students. And we try to attract students to come to this event that wouldn't necessarily attend a suicide prevention event.
Yeah.
So it's really a wellness with a concentration on mental health.
It's a great idea, and I know that our earlier emailer actually was talking about getting this into the schools at the K-12 level. It seems as though something like this at a variety of levels would make a lot of sense.
Yes.
Yeah. I want to go to Linda in Middletown. Hi, Linda. Go ahead quickly if you would.
Hi. My 14-year-old came to me about a month and a half ago with suicide ideation, which totally scared me. And I got her into, luckily, counseling within 24 hours. And then she saw a psychiatrist within another week or two and is now on medication. Seems to be doing better. But my question is, going forward, what should I be looking for? Hopefully she's going to be honest and open and tell me where she's at. But I don't know if that's always going to be the case.
Linda, thank you very much for your question and listen in. I know that the doctors are always, we don't want to do too much diagnosis over the air, but I'd love to hear your thoughts for what Linda has to say.
Well, Linda, I think that's so fantastic that you were able to get your child into care and that you sought care early and it went efficiently. I always love to hear those kind of stories. But certainly when, again, you have an adolescent who's now been identified, I like to think of that as tier two now in terms of what you want to think about, particularly around prevention. So I would make sure in particular that your house is safety proofed. That is so key to me once you've identified a child with mental health difficulties. And then to just maintain open dialogue and continue discourse. Somebody mentioned problem solving. You know, that is the thing that gets, I think, both adolescents and adults in trouble, that at that moment of vulnerability, at that moment of stress and disappointment and sadness, grief perhaps, the skills around problem solving are what seem to dissipate. So as much work that can be done on that, again, along with honest and open communication, and it sounds to me like you're on the right track.
Linda, thank you again for your phone call. We got a tweet from Mark as we run low on time. I want to get to a few more things. Tuned in late, Mark says, but has the overrepresentation of GLBT youth in suicide been addressed? If not, it should be. Thank you, Mark. It should be. So can we talk about this?
Absolutely right. At the Institute of Living, we're starting a program this year focused on GLBT youth, specifically with the recognition that this is a group that's underserved in terms of mental health issues in general and in terms of suicide issues.
I want to ask, did you want to jump in quickly, Andrea?
Sure. Yeah, I was going to say one of the primary focuses on our campus initiative are also trying to increase the resources to LGBT youth and sense of connectedness on campuses as well among that population and for that population.
There is a study that suggests that although these kids are at risk for suicidal attempts and behavior, they're not necessarily at higher risk for completed suicide. So what that means is, again, there's an opportunity. So if you're evaluating a child, an adolescent who has had a suicide attempt, that is something that has to be key in your evaluation. You know, what is happening in the realm of gender and sexuality?
Can't emphasize enough, Andrea used the word connectivity, that the absence of a sense of connectivity is probably one of the greatest risk factors for suicide in all age groups, combined with a sense of burdensomeness, the sense that there really is no help that's going to apply to me to make my situation better. And lastly, with means, with the gun or with the overdose. Connectivity, sense of burden, lack of connectivity, sense of burden, and the presence of suicide means.
Is there any new, in the last minute that we have, is there any new research right now into the causes of suicide? Anything we should be looking at now?
Well, we can't really get to the causes, but we are getting through research to some of the ways of detecting who may be at greater risk. So we're doing research with MRI scans, functional MRI, and with PET scans, positron emission tomography, that demonstrates that the brains of people who are at higher risk may actually look different on these scans, and we may at some point be able to use them to help us with our predictions. We also know that there are some genetic connections that may predict those who are at greater risk. These are both in the research stages, not clinically applicable yet. We still rely on the skilled interview, and the skilled interview still relies on the patient to tell us what's really on his or her mind.
Mm. That's Dr. Harold Schwartz, psychiatrist in chief and vice president of behavioral health at Hartford Hospital and the Institute of Living. We are also joined by Dr. Lisa Namoureau from Hartford Hospital, Andrea Duarte from the Connecticut Department of Mental Health and Addiction Services, and Marissa Porco, who's president of the Jordan Matthew Porco Memorial Foundation. Again, if you're in immediate need of assistance, the number to call that we've been talking about throughout this program is 211. Where We Live is produced by Tucker Ives and Lydia Brown. The executive producer is Katie Talarski. I'm John Dankosky, and this is Where We Live.